Hello and welcome back, everybody, to the Research VR podcast, the podcast about the science of virtual reality. I'm your host, Oz Balabanian, and with me today is a new guest, Jessica Outlaw from her company, ExtendedMind.io. Hello, Jessica.
Hi. Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. And of course, my wonderful co-host, Peter Luckoff, is joining from Germany.
Hello.
Hey, Peter.
Hello, hello, hello.
So again, thank you for joining us, Jessica. We've been talking about doing this podcast for like the past like 3 or 4 months, and finally we have our act together and actually starting to record new episodes. And I think this is going to be a really interesting topic that hasn't been talked about much, at least, you know, in a general public setting. And it's a really important topic, as well as a kind of a sensitive topic. So I want to be very cognizant of that. And I think this topic should, you know, needs kind of a stage to be discussed amongst men and women, and for VR developers and designers to really understand, you know, what is happening. But before we jump into all of that, why don't you kind of tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, how you ended up into VR, and why you're doing what you're doing?
Yeah, sure. So I'm a social scientist. I've loved research forever. I used to work on clinical trials and getting cardiac implants approved by the FDA. And that was a long time ago. But that was how I started my career in research. Afterwards, I went to graduate school and I studied the topic of judgment and decision making. And so I got really immersed in like all of the behavioral science related to judgment and decision making. I got my master's from UC San Diego in 2014. And then I started doing just some really standard web like UX research. And I just felt like there was this huge disconnect between like all of my social science training in grad school and what I was able to do as a UX researcher. And it was really frustrating for me until I got to try VR. So I tried VR in like 2015, 2016, and I was like, oh, this is like a perfect application for applying all of these behavioral insights. So one of the big topics in grad school was embodied cognition and how we're able to process information differently when we're using our bodies as part of that. So for example, somebody was telling me a story about an Olympic swimmer, and this is just an example of embodied cognition. Somebody was telling me about like somebody who was in the Paralympics as a swimmer who was a paraplegic. And as soon as she said paraplegic, she pointed at her legs and it became like very intuitive to me, like, oh, all right, that's what she's. So she was communicating with gestures and it was helping me understand like all of her stories. And so that's just one like very brief example of how gestures can influence language. They can influence thought. And so that's just one brief example of how you can use behavioral science to communicate better. And, you know, getting back to VR, the opportunities for communication and training are just fantastic in VR. So that's like in a nutshell of like the types of research that I think are really possible in VR that you can't do in, you know, other types of spaces.
Absolutely. I think we probably come from a similar, you know, interest and fascination when it comes to social behavioral cues and how VR really came at like the perfect time in our academic careers, where we were like, wait, this is everything we've been learning about applied in one product. So actually, can you kind of tell us a little bit about the first experience you had with VR and what kind of what that led you into wanting to explore and thinking about?
Yeah. The first thing I ever did was The Lab by Valve. And I just like having that series of mini games was really influential to me. And in fact, it was so influential that, when I was part of Oculus Launchpad last year, one of the idea that I applied for was to basically recreate like a series of mini games around a specific topic in social science. And so I think that since the lab was one of the first things I tried, it really influenced me in terms of, you know, there's these opportunities to create like these mini experiences, but tie them together in a theme.
I see. I mean, why did you end up working on it? That sounds like a really interesting idea.
Oh, okay. So, So the Oculus Launchpad project, it turned out, it is on the topic of, implicit bias. And so there's 20 years of research from Harvard about how there's all of these implicit biases that people have, and it's related to gender, it's related to race, age, like people, like old people are very heavily discriminated against. There's a ton of biases against many, many different types of people. And the thing is that it's, they track it by testing reaction times. So how quickly do you associate, you know, male in engineering compared to, you know, females and liberal arts?
Right.
And so if anybody's interested, they can go to the implicit bias project at Harvard and you can take all of the implicit bias tests. So what I was really interested in was trying to understand what this would mean in the context of virtual reality. And are there ways to bring non-conscious bias training or implicit bias training to a very particular set of people, public school teachers? Because in the classroom, there are like basically students of color are treated differently than white students. So they tend to be disciplined at higher rates. They are also punished more severely. So not only are they punished more often, they're also punished more severely. And they're also less likely to be tracked into AP courses or advanced placement courses. And so it's kind of a double whammy. So rather than starting out with like this huge, huge problem of bias in like American society, I tried to get really, really like niche on like, all right, white public school teachers, in this particular field. So I partnered, I met, Clorama Dorvilius.
Sure.
You know Clo?
Yeah. Great. I actually met her once. Yeah.
Oh, excellent. Excellent. Yeah. She's in San Francisco. And she was also at Oculus Launchpad with me. And so she and I partnered and created this experience. And then we learned in December that we won Oculus Launchpad. So now we have funding to fully execute it. And ooh, so it will.
Nice.
Thank you. So it'll be in the Oculus store later this year. And then we can also expand it to other platforms as well.
Cool.
But I think, like, our eventual goal is to expand it beyond public school teachers, but this just gives like a very specific way to start. It builds on tons of existing education research, and it's a translation into like making this meaningful inside of VR. And I did get feedback from an education professor. I was like, well, do you think this training would be effective in virtual reality? And she said yes, because she said that public school teachers hate reading. Like at the end of the day, like they have so much grading to do and like they're so exhausted that she was optimistic about our approach just because it was something new and something fresh.
That's absolutely fascinating.
I actually have a few questions
that go for it, Peter.
Are related to what we discussed right now. And I want them to be a little bit clearer to the audience before we dive into the main topic. So you mentioned embodied cognition and the embodiment itself and also the biases. And what I wanted to ask you is whether you, in your research or in your work, would distinguish between embodied cognition and embedded cognition, and also whether, for example, the example that you made with a Paralympic sportsman pointing out to his body is more him using his external world rather than just his body. Because as far as I understand, and please correct me if I'm wrong, the embodied cognition is more about the mind using the body to process thoughts. But when you, for example, signal someone that, you know, I have something with my leg, or you signal someone, please take over that box over there, it's also kind of this embodied language research that kind of sees when people can, you know, show to each other things or describe objects, it's better for them, for the performance to grab. So do you distinguish between embedded and embodied cognition?
defining embedded cognition again? Is that the box example you just gave?
Yeah, I think from my poor understanding, the embedded cognition is when you use your external world to finish a task. So let's say you have a puzzle in front of you, right? And you would pick certain parts of it and you would put them together. You're using your external world to solve an issue. But you could also just look at the puzzle and, you know, try to solve it in your mind. And while you try to solve it in your mind, you could imagine how you grab a part and put it there. And that would kind of be embedded cognition because you imagine putting it together versus you actually do it physically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In that story, I was not distinguishing between embedded cognition and embodied cognition. I think the larger point was about how, you know, we're not just brains in vats, like walking around, from meeting to meeting. Like our bodies are not, you know, transport mechanisms from meeting to meeting. So I think the reason I named my company The Extended Mind is that's like that term about how, you know, we use all of these things in our environment. Like, for example, the temperature, like they've done studies where they've changed the temperature of a lab and then it affects people's belief in global warming. And so there's all of these things. Yeah. So I think most generally it's about how there's things that influence the way that we think or the way that we feel that we might not be, that might be in our environment that we might not even be aware of.
All these subconscious cues really influencing like decision making. And that's absolutely fascinating. I'd love to dive a little bit deeper into that. Before we do, so you mentioned implicit biases, and I think this brings us back to like one of our earliest episodes where back in the day when we were still really into reading papers, I remember we discussed a paper that was about using virtual reality to so embodying a person of color's avatar in VR and that having an effect on the implicit biases that you have and actually reducing that implicit bias. I'd have to find the paper again, but have you seen that paper or read it?
Yeah, I think it was a university in Spain that did that. Sound right?
That sounds about right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, because I think there's that whole element of perspective taking that's involved with that. And then Jeremy Bailenson's lab in Stanford has also done a lot of research on how, like, the different avatars that you choose can also subsequently affect your behavior. So I think all of these different research studies are supporting the idea that, you know, when you take on, you know, a black avatar or a really tall or powerful looking avatar or maybe a more feminine avatar, it can subsequently change your behavior.
Totally.
And so I think the most important like that is that, you know, these things that you might not think would make a difference actually do.
Totally. It's I think the Proteus effect that one of Bailenson's PhD students,
right.
Jeremy, oh God, I'm really bad at names. But yeah, that was like they did that research back in the day when they were using like World of Warcraft and like looking at the height of avatars and affecting, do you remember that?
Yes.
Affecting like the aggressiveness of the of the interactions, how intimate they became. And then I think they even went further into VR and they realized like, yeah, these effects are real. And actually this back into another Stanford study that was done in like the 70s, the Zimbardo's prison experiment, where, you know, if we're talking about embodying different characters, different clothing, different type of people, the Stanford prison experiment was conducted, you know, they took in normal college students and half of them were given prison guard uniforms and half of them, the other half were prisoners. And suddenly the prison guards, the people that were, you know, were embodying prison guards became way more aggressive. And so that just kind of plays into the idea of like, you become the mask that you put on or the clothes that you wear or the thing that you're pretending to be. And that really does change your behavior. So, yeah, that's such a fascinating topic.
It's really that like measuring actual behavior change that's so interesting. And I think that's why I think Bailenson's getting and like his students on the Proteus effect. I think the reason that the Proteus effect study is so clever is because they like looked at how people felt and they looked at their behavior in world, but then they after they took the VR goggles off, they gave them actual behavioral measures. So there's these econ games. Are you familiar with the Ultimatum game? It's where basically with like, So it's like two people in a lab and like I get to decide how many to give you. And if I'm more collaborative, I'll offer Peter 50. But if I'm not collaborative, I'll offer him 10 or 20 of those points. And, you know, maybe it translates to dollars or something like that. And so in the Proteus Effect study, what they did is they had people take off the goggles, and the people who had the more like powerful avatars, the taller avatars, the more physically imposing ones, they shared less of the 100 points. And the people who had the smaller avatars that weren't like so physically imposing and powerful were much more collaborative and shared closer to 50-50.
Yeah, it's very interesting. So, I mean, in general, as externalists believe that the mind is not being able to exist without the external world because you kind of use it in your thought process. I mean, there's also the idea that basically the way how we perceive reality is just based on our sensory motor contingencies. So how we actually form contingencies in our mind between what we do with the world and how the world changes. So when I take my hands and close my eyes, I don't see anymore. That's how the brain learns a certain connection between that. Because if you have a baby who is just born, the brain might potentially not even know you have eyes and ears, but it can, you know, start to wiggle with the arms randomly, and suddenly it closes its eyes, it doesn't see anymore, so it starts to form patterns. And that obviously goes further into the social construct that we are quite good at, particularly the humans, because it's something that we rely on to form the very complex social interactions with our mates, right? And there seems to be a lot of factors who influence it. So that's why VR is obviously...
They don't exist in a vat, right?
No.
Like they're very much a product of what is connected to the brain. So yeah, that's absolutely fascinating. I think let's dive a little bit deeper into the paper that you wrote that kind of really caught a lot of people's attention, including ours. It's called "Why Women Don't Like Social Virtual Reality: A Study of Safety, Usability, and Self-Expression in Social VR." And Jessica, actually, before we even go into the findings of the research, what was your first social VR experience? And can you tell us a little bit about what that was and how, you know, was that a contributing factor into leading you to wanting to research this topic?
Yes. Yes. Let's see, I don't know if this was the first social VR experience, but I did go into Rec Room, and it was just so loud and cacophonous, and like, and the entry, I don't know if it's still this way, but like at the time, the entry point was like you were in the dorm room and then you went into the locker room, and this was like after like October 2016, and so locker room and like locker room talk like had a different like meaning. And so like there was that, like, oh great, I'm in a locker room. And then this young girl, it sounded like she was maybe 13, she might have been younger, but like as soon as she heard that I had a female voice, she just came up to me and she was like, oh, I really want to hang out with you. She was like, oh, thank God.
I found another one.
And it just it felt so incredibly gendered, that like this entirely random person like felt like there was safety being next to me, even though it was my first time in Rec Room and it's not like I knew how anything worked. And then I ended up doing some of the mini games there, but I think that was probably one of the first things that I ever did social VR.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, that makes sense. And I'm sure, you know, the current landscape of multiplayer and social VR experience, I guess, really differ between different apps. And I think you start to talk a little bit in your paper, the different cultures and the different behaviors that are permitted and some, I guess, that are encouraged or discouraged. I guess the idea of culture, like how, and I mean, up until now, I've thought of a lot of software cultures, like different cultures on Instagram, different, you know, the way you interact with others on Facebook or Instagram or Reddit are all very separate things. How do you think that translates into VR? And is that something that's apparent to you already?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's been fascinating to see how the different cultures have emerged and like how closely held a culture can be. So there's certain like social VR apps, like I'm thinking about normal VR right now. Like that is an invite only app. It's tiny. Like they're extremely like, I think the way that it works, I think the way their code of conduct is like, let's say, so I'm a normal VR member and let's say I invite Peter in and let's say Peter pisses off some people.
I would never do that.
And Peter gets kicked out. I know. Well, then the consequence is that I also get kicked out. And so in a way, like I am responsible for the behavior of all of the people that I invite in.
Oh, interesting.
And so, but that's a very conscious choice that they have made because they want people to feel a certain level of responsibility and accountability. And so that is, I think that's an example of a company that's trying that, like, growth is not the absolute target right now. You know, they're, if you've looked at normal VR, people might know normal the most from the open source keyboard that they made, right. Like the drummer, xylophone keyboard.
The one that speaks back to you when you type. Yeah.
Right. So they, like they have a very particular aesthetic. And, you know, like, that's one approach to it. And so their culture is going to be really, really different. Like they've said, like, this is our aesthetic. These are our values.
Right.
If like you invite people that aren't cool and don't act cool, you're going to be held accountable and you can't be part of our group anymore. And so that's a very, very different approach compared to anybody who's like on Steam right now. And, and I think, you know, there's a lot of like interesting things happening, but I think the culture you get is the culture that you build.
Yes. I mean, there is a good example with the current meme going around VR chat, I think, with brother, do you know the way? Do you know the way, brother? So people just randomly choosing a character that is very ugly, annoying, little, running around at huge hordes and annoying everyone else.
Let's explain this a little bit not everyone might know this meme that we're referencing. So over the past like month or two, VR chat has been becoming extremely popular on just random internet communities, including, you know, Reddit and 4chan, whatever, the usual gaming side of the internet. And particularly because it's not just a VR experience, you know, you can download it on your computer and be in the same world as VR members. And it also has the ability to import custom avatars. Yes. And so people have just been like, kind of building their own meme-like characters. And anyway, this became a kind of a viral video that was like some silly stuff happening. And it invites all the plethora of the internet into this experience.
Yes.
And I mean, you can imagine the type of experiences you'll have when you're standing around in a room that are, you're just getting memes yelled at you.
Basically by 100 people. I mean, it's very funny to watch it on YouTube, but I'm pretty sure the app becomes quite unusable because it's so just filled
in
with
terms
Uganda
of cultures,
searching knuckles.
Right. In terms of cultures that we were just discussing, like clearly VR chat has now
a very kind of hostile
has this culture. I wouldn't say necessarily it's, or by default, it's a culture, it's a hostile thing, but it's a type of
provocative
interaction
one
that you'll have in that app compared to if you go to Altspace or even Rec Room or something like Big Screen that we're in.
I mean, honestly, it makes me so curious about what it's like to be an employee of VR chat because does VR chat, are they like thoughtful about their employee?
I think they're scared.
Or
I think they're worried.
I'm pretty sure
they're really, really
worried.
I mean, the thing is that there's, so I actually did a project with High Fidelity last year around the question of like what makes people feel welcome in an online community. And, you know, what's appealing to people about like what would it be like to invite people into high fidelity and what would make them want to like keep coming back and like trying new things in high fidelity. And so I found like Philip and really like all of the employees of high fidelity extremely thoughtful. I mean, I think there were definitely issues of griefing, but I also think that, like they regularly like banned people if there were like, if somebody was a multiple offender. Like, yeah. I think my understanding was that they got banned. I mean, they had live moderators like in the welcome area of high fidelity, which I think like for 14 hours a day.
Wow.
Whoa.
Reminds you of Altspace, actually. I believe they had ambassadors that would be in these environments as right. moderators.
I mean, that's the same as in forums, such, right? Yeah. In forums, you also had to use moderators to keep the flooding and the spamming away, right?
Right. So really, like in doing that high fidelity project, I drew on so much existing science research and organizational behavior research because, you know, the idea of like, how do you build a strong culture and how do you make people feel welcome? How do you make people feel part of a group is very, very well established. I mean, if you think about like, what was it like for your first week of orientation at undergrad? You know, did people go on camping trips together? Like, I don't know what comes up for you. What were those things that they bonded, that they used to bond you together that first time when you arrived?
I mean, you usually have some kind of people, right, who help you out, who are, you know, responsible for your first week and just, you know, get you together and explain your stuff. Also, you know that there are a lot of freshmen, so it's like the bounding of the freshmen, right?
There were also rituals.
Right. So I was going to say that it's like, I felt it was like half kind of organized bonding, or like the major gets all the people that are in a similar department together, and you do this and that, and then but also in the dorms where you're kind of paired with people from every department, you have other types of rituals, including drinking, and you know, you can imagine the types of things that go on in freshman college dorms. But actually, so that's fascinating. How, when you're approaching, let's say, like a company or an app like High Fidelity, where do you start in terms of drawing in this previous research, or what are like the main ones that always you almost like kind of imagine how you have a backpack and you have all this research that is super relevant every time and you pull out,
like a lawyer.
Like, what would you say those really translate into VR interactions that you seem to reference them?
I mean, I think ritual is probably one of the most important things because, you know, my undergrad, we had rituals that we did. Every company that I've ever like worked at, like there were certain rituals. Just on like on a very like human level, like we connect to other people, when you create containers like that. So there's this idea called collective effervescence. And it's actually an extremely powerful idea from sociology. And so if you imagine that like last night, the three of us like went to a concert and it was like amazing music. It was our favorite band. And then like the next day, like let's say we're hanging out, like we could relive that experience and be like, oh my gosh, could you believe they played that song? That was so powerful. And then you could say like, what it was about the concert that was really powerful for you. And so by creating those events and then like letting multiple people in to experience it, those experiences have a life beyond like when the experience ends, because the three of us would then be bonded together and we would have that memory and we would have all of those emotions from that experience.
And VR being such a powerful immersive experience, you can imagine if you have a multiplayer experience of going through this thing, you know, that could be really bonding, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Right.
Another thing that I think is really that would be inside of my backpack is this whole idea of like, how people, what is important to you? And so there's really explicit ways of telling people what's important to you. So I think it was in Altspace's welcome area. They had, I don't know if it was exactly a code of conduct, but they had like this wall of text where they told you like how they wanted you to behave. thank you. And so like that's an example of like really explicit ways of telling people the behavior that you expect. It doesn't have to be like that though. Like there are, you know, if you like invite people, if the first place where people arrive is, you know, a meadow and it's really calm and there's really, really calm music, you're also communicating to them, you know, what the energy of the area is. Or in the high fidelity example, there's a ton of people who go into high fidelity every day and just like hang out with each other and chat with each other and tend to be like really, really friendly, like to each other and to newcomers. And so what it is it's teaching other people, like, this is what our culture is. Like, come over here and talk with us and be really, really chill.
But for that, you need people who regularly visit it and share this culture, right? So if you would have people joining in for 2 days and leaving out, unless you have really moderators, there's no way to maintain a culture.
Right.
Or you can hope that your community, you know, you're building a good enough community that is encouraging that you know, you're setting the example by being the moderator, but it has to be the ones that are implementing it.
Yes.
Right.
So, okay.
So I guess let's go a little bit into the paper.
Yes.
So this is a paper that you co-wrote with Beth Duckles. Did I pronounce that right?
Yes.
Actually, yeah. Why don't you kind of give us an overview of this paper?
Sure. So I had just completed the High Fidelity project on social VR last April when I was planning this out. I had this really strong feeling that the people who I was meeting in VR didn't have a lot of experience with qualitative research. And because I'd met like people at multiple different industries or just from many different companies. I'd talked to people at VR conferences, and when I started talking about some of my previous work doing qualitative research, it just didn't seem like, I really didn't think that, like, I was effectively telling people what the value of qualitative research was. And it felt like if I could run my own qualitative research study and, like, show the VR industry, this is the potential of qualitative research, and these are the types of questions that qualitative research could answer, that I could have a much better starting point for those conversations. And so that was what motivated the idea of doing a qualitative research study.
Cool.
And then for how did I choose the topic? I just thought it would be cool to bring in people, like basically millennials. So I went in very young women who were tech savvy, who were on social media every day. You know, some of them were like software engineers. And I wanted to, because I wanted to see, from like a new person's perspective, a newcomer's perspective, were the issues that I saw in social VR prevalent, you know, across all women? Or is it something about like, you know, I'm too old and I'm not tech savvy enough that, you know, I was having these issues. So I really set up the study in a way to learn something new, because I think I wanted to set up, I purposely recruited, you know, women who are like 22, 23, 24 and find out like, is it a women's issue or is it an age issue? And like really select, I really tried to recruit women who could have potentially had very excellent times in social VR.
And even potential,
that was how I
potential buyers of the technology, right? Or like had the means absolutely. To.
As a potential early adopters. Now,
absolutely.
How did the procedure work out? How did you test them?
Oh, Peter, I'm so glad you asked. Also, on my website, you can download the 3-page methods from, from the study in case anyone would like to replicate the methods.
Yeah, because it's actually worth doing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's certainly worth doing it. It's like actually a very fascinating study. So how did you test them?
Thank you for the question. All right, so I'll give a brief summary. And because the reason that I publish my methods is because I am trying to make qualitative research more common in virtual reality. I mean, I know people are giving demos to new people. What I'm really trying to do is add a level of rigor to it and let people know, like, it's not that hard to do some really legitimate qualitative research in VR. So how did I do it? So I was very specific about who I recruited. The youngest person, I think, was 22. The median age was 30. They were all people in Portland. They had all never used VR for more than like 30 minutes. So maybe they had gone to a conference and used it and like done a demo or something. Then they were still eligible, but they couldn't have spent more than 30 minutes in VR. And more importantly, they had never been inside social VR. They had to like demonstrate a level of tech savviness. So they had to rate themselves as being high in tech savviness. They had to demonstrate to me that they, you know, own smartphones and that they were also very active on social media, because I didn't want to, I thought it would be weird to bring people into social VR if, you know, they were like extremely introverted and never interacted with strangers online.
Almost trying to create a baseline of like, you know, in I guess UX stuff that you would call this like a persona or like an ideal, you know, user of your product, and you're trying, and I guess you wanted to create an entire study around around that and actually anyway.
Yeah, that was exactly what my goal was. So then once.
I should mention that I think you were calling, you call this a inductive research study, where you don't have a particular hypothesis from the beginning to prove or disprove, but you have an idea, you want to what research questions arise from this. And I think that's exactly what, you know, you end up discovering. There's a lot that you gain from just doing a qualitative study with a smaller sample size that you can really, you know, dig into each person and understand.
Thank you for pointing that out. Yeah, that was definitely one of the goals, because I didn't want, because I honestly did not have an agenda. Like, I purposely recruited people who were very young and tech savvy, you know, who had engineering degrees, in order to set social VR up in the easiest audience possible among females. And that, and so, yes, it was inductive. A thing, I set up the study in a way that I could have found something entirely opposite to the results that I found.
Mm. Fair. So I guess let's start a little bit about the way you set it up. You wanted to test people that had almost no experience in multiple different social VR experiences, and to see to see what happened. So what happened?
Right. What happened? So social VR creepy.
Mm-hmm.
In a word, they found it very disconcerting that people were in their space. They said that it would not be the preferred communication mechanism. Of the 13 people who were in my study, only one stated she was interested in acquiring any VR hardware for herself. Everyone else had this attitude of like, nope, this is not for me.
Mm.
There were multiple, so, you know, we've kind of touched on what the social dynamics were, but it was very, very challenging for people. So what we observed was people, like the women in the study, had no idea how to interact. They had no clue what the social norms were. And so what I observed them doing when they were in, for example, Facebook Spaces was the third, platform that I tested. And so what I observed is that in Rec Room and AltSpace, the women would, they would just walk around groups. They would walk on the perimeter. And they would try to not attract attention, which is actually something very similar that women do in real life, like crossing the street to avoid a group. And so what it was is there was like there were so many questions about how to act and how to behave in a way to, that they would feel safe, that they were basically by the end of the 30-minute demo, they were just like ready to take the headset off. Not one of the participants was like, hey, can I have an extra 10 minutes in here?
Mm. The question that comes to mind is, do you remember, in terms of the participants and the worlds that they were in, what the like the gender ratio was of the other people that were in? I mean, that's hard to control, of course, with these this type of study, mm-hmm. especially if it's a real life, it's happening in the real world, right, or the VR world. But
mm-hmm.
Was there a difference that you would notice if there were more women in the world versus if it was all guys? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a good question. Something that comes up is that in Rec Room, it just sounded like children screaming.
Sure.
it wasn't necessarily all males. And I think for what I've just described, in terms of like the creepiness factor of like navigating to avoid, that wasn't an issue in Facebook Spaces because you cannot hang out with anyone in Facebook Spaces.
Mm, exactly.
Who you're not already Facebook friends with. Exactly. So they've like really limited it inside of that infrastructure. So these safety concerns and these privacy concerns were gone from Facebook Spaces. But the more important like thing that ran across all three of the platforms was that people didn't feel like there was something for them to do.
Mm. Yeah.
So they didn't enjoy like just talking with other people. Like that was not going to replace like them texting people or calling them mm-hmm. on the phone, or Skyping with them. So that part wasn't appealing. Like they specifically called out like these cartoony avatars as being unappealing
right.
mm-hmm.
to them. And so that ran across all three platforms.
And I remember even reading from multiple participants, them even being like not interested in wanting yep. to customize their avatar
yes.
because one of them said that like, I don't see any of, and none of the hairstyles match what my hair looks like. So mm. I don't even care. You know, like I was like, oh, that's interesting. You know, I would have thought the opposite, that people would want to customize to make it either look like them or not look like them.
Yes.
But
so, all in all, I would highly recommend anyone listening to actually read the study because it's highly fascinating for anyone who is related to VR to understand that there are certain barriers, whether they are gender specific or not, to you know social experiences. And if we want to build something that is you know truly amazing, as an experience, we need still to go further away because. Well, big screen to me, for example, is like super nice because I kind of know you two or I just met you, but we kind of have a context. I personally myself also struggle with just, you know, logging into White Space or any other social VR applications.
Sure.
Because I, to be honest, kind of have the same issues as the woman in the studies have. I don't understand what I'm supposed to do there. And I also kind of get lost easily because I don't see a context. And sure, with our colleagues, we sometimes log into Rec Room and play against each other. But not really against random people.
Mm-hmm.
So it can be fun, but all in all.
I mean, it's similar to like, you know, early internet days where you have a chat room where they're just random people from the internet in there just typing away, you know, that you can imagine the horrendous things that will just be said to random people. Comparing that to like a direct message between two Facebook friends. Yeah. I think, like, do you think that's a fair comparison between... So a general social VR and like something like a Facebook Spaces.
Yeah. Yeah. It definitely could be. Like there's that open world and where privacy is not the default. And so I think that was probably I came out with four recommendations at the end of the study.
Yeah.
And the first recommendation is that privacy must be the default. If you want to appeal to like, you know, half of the population.
Right.
Because I think it can't be understated yeah. how like unsafe the women felt inside of the open worlds. Like there was just a level of unsafe that they felt that I included so many like direct quotes.
Yes, you did.
From the women in the report. And so what I would say for people who don't want to read the entire report is just read the quotes from the women. Like right. You can skip any of my analysis, but just read the quotes from the women, because I think that that would give you a really good sense of what it was like to mm-hmm. have for their first, what was their first in social VR.
Actually, a question to the participants. So what I was reading in the quotes is that many women have mentioned being, you know, having certain moments in their life where they have been already harassed or was certain level of threat that they experienced, that the VR kind of reminded them of the real life events they had mm-hmm. that were negative. Could that be a potential bias in the subject group that you for some reason already had women who had negative experience from real life, or would you say that this is not relevant?
Oh, I mean, I think that's a really good question. If you can find me women who have not experienced harassment,
yeah.
I will rerun the study. Sure. There's Cornell did a study that by age 17, 80% of women have experienced harassment.
Yeah, I think you quoted it somewhere.
You know,
there,
even
yeah.
if it's just street harassment.
Can't even control for that,
so,
honestly.
Yeah, you quoted that in your paper, I remember.
Right.
So I think it's a valid question. Like, how would it be different?
Wouldn't have such
if
a shitty
these
world
women hadn't had experience.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, they're obviously like a lot of their behavior comes from past experiences and that creates expectations.
Yeah.
And I mean, a lot of this, I'd say, I mean, it's super insightful. The first time I had my girlfriend try a social VR experience. And to me, like when I tried Rec Room for the first time, I was like, this is amazing. It solved a lot of early social VR problems where there was just nothing that you would do in there. You know, you would just stand around and look at each other and talk
yeah.
to, oh, look, there's a Frisbee, there's a ball, there's yeah. something interesting at least going on. And like me being an active and kind of like, I don't know, personable person, like I would just go up to people, like hang out, you know, throw balls, whatever.
But you're also very
and then
social.
I was like, yeah, I would consider myself on a more extroverted side of the yeah. scale, but I had my girlfriend try it out, and the first thing I saw her do was, like, I saw her shoulders go up, kind of when she realized there are people around her. I saw her getting guarded, and I saw her making some distance between her and herself, and immediately, like, she did not have a good time, and so, anyway, I was telling her about we were doing this podcast today, and she was like, well, you better talk about, you know, my experience, because I know these are things that I just could not have. It wasn't, I guess, in the realm of possibilities in my mind, because I haven't experienced harassment to that same point and built up those defenses yeah. to strangers that a person that has been harassed has.
True.
I mean, I'd say most of women have experienced that. And, you know, it wouldn't be that stretch of an imagination to imagine, you know, smaller, I would say like male people kind of feeling, you know, I think size differences makes a big difference, right? In terms of how you people.
Yeah.
True.
Yeah. Yeah. It was interesting to observe how women brought in their existing defenses.
Yeah.
So at least two women like made sure that the people around them knew they had a boyfriend.
Right. Yes. Yeah.
That was a
like
big
they,
point.
They like made sure to like insert that. Like, I mean, getting back to this whole idea of, I think Rec Room instituted like a voice pitch manipulation
yeah.
like, since the study was run, so you can have a lower voice or a higher
mm-hmm.
voice. But I'm on the PSVR Facebook group, mm-hmm. and apparently someone was posting that like men are like making their voices higher and like trying to bring children into like private rooms in Rec Room, and it's
mm.
so. I just, it, like, there's no silver bullet. Like, it's not a matter of, like, you can adjust your avatar size or you can adjust your voice. I really just come back to this whole idea of how do you build a culture of safety and privacy?
Okay, but then I would ask maybe a rather strange question, but if what we discussed is true and you bring a lot of those negative experience from the real life into the virtual social life, right? Wouldn't it mean that before we solve like the harassment in the real world, it's kind of impossible to solve certain issues in the virtual world, or would you say that the virtual world gives us opportunity to relieve people from their guard system and basically creates so good private environments that they feel safe?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say the second one.
Okay.
That virtual worlds do have the opportunity to make it so we can't bring in our existing stereotypes and our existing biases.
This goes back
to like the implicit bias that we were talking about earlier about, so for example, who are old, like they're perceived as having really bad memories, and just not being as intelligent. And so, in VR, you don't, like, age is no longer a variable. Another example would be, like, don't bring in existing markers. Don't bring existing markers of gender. Don't bring in existing markers of race. Mm-hmm. So, for example, NASCAR is seen as a very, like, low-class activity, and sailing is seen as a very high-class activity. And so if you're building a VR experience, are you, like, building in things like NASCAR and, like, sailing that people already have, like, very strong associations about? So this is the real potential of VR, I think, is to, like, we don't have to, we can create brand new associations in VR. We can find new groups of people that we wouldn't necessarily socialize with in real life. But we find, like, communion with them on virtual worlds. Maybe we have similar interests. Maybe we're all, like, fans of, you know, one particular, you know, 3D artist, and there's a community of people around that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think another one of the big recommendations that came out of this paper was, like, make it enticing. Like, give people something really fun to do. Mm-hmm. And let the community form around, like, that fun thing to do. Because I think when you give people things to do that are going to fit their interests, that is going to lead to better behavior overall.
Mm-hmm.
Give them a distraction in a sense, and then they can bond over, you know, trying to figure out that distraction.
Yeah. Would you say?
Or even.
Yeah.
Sorry, yeah, go for it, Peter.
Would you say that every VR social experience would need to be safe, or would you say that there needs to be maybe different levels? So, like in the real internet, or basically, there are some places that are, you know, more troll friendly, and people can just troll each other, and the real internet. And there are places.
That's a good question, Peter. Yeah, thank you for the question. I'm not trying to shut anyone down. I'm just saying the recommendations that I'm giving are, do you want your platform to appeal to half of the population?
True.
Right.
And if the answer is yes, then
you should,
I think,
obviously,
spend some time thinking about privacy.
I think,
thinking about safety.
But
if that's not what your goal is, if you have other goals, I mean, build the platform that, you know, matches your goals.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a very fair point. It's, what do you want your app to be? What do you want people to be doing in there? Is it a one-on-one conversation, or is it general be there? I think what would be interesting to talk about is probably the history of this entire topic that we're discussing, you know, the topic of harassment and women in VR. I think the major one that I can remember is the first story that came out on CNN about a woman kind of being harassed in Quiver, which is this another social kind of, So this was a 2016. It kind of started picking up some steam, and, you know, people were like, wait, what's going on in virtual reality? You can touch each other, like, or you can be in each other's faces. I don't want to say, like, it was inevitable, but, like, from the first time I tried AltSpace, I, like, recommended back to them the idea of, like, privacy bubbles need to be a thing, and nobody up until that point had implemented it. And so when that story became a big thing, thankfully the Quiver developers implemented a kind of like defensive poses where I don't remember the specific.
And I think they made them open source. Right. Like they made this power gesture, and I think they put it online for anyone. That, like, if you moved your arms away, then you would have this protective bubble come up. So I think I think they really did try to respond. You know, I would just it just honestly baffles me that they didn't include any like early testing with like females, because I think they would have gotten insight a lot earlier, and yes. You know, they wouldn't have gotten the CNN coverage. Okay. So I think that leads to like the fourth takeaway that I had, which is ask questions, like really, really try to do qualitative research with people who have a range of experience levels. So maybe you bring in people who are very, very comfortable with the VR controllers,
yeah.
Or maybe people who have a ton of gaming experience and understand the controllers easily. What I did is I recruited people who were not VR experts. And so, and a lot of them, some of them had like Nintendo Switches at home, but like they struggled with the controllers. And they just struggled with like finding the menus and opening the menus,
yes.
And finding all of the options right. on the menus.
Yes.
And so that would be something I would really encourage people to do. And that's why I put my methodology right. online, is so that way people can run their own studies.
You also split the participants between half being on Vive and half on Rift. And I don't think you saw any significant ergonomic differences between people figuring out how to control the controllers, right? Like that was a huge thing that kept coming up and up, not just physical button, you know, confusions, but as well as mm-hmm. UI confusion.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we should talk a little bit about that.
Like people cannot, Oh yeah, people cannot find the grip button. It's incredibly difficult.
Yes, it is.
And then it was
it's incredible.
And then I think AltSpace, their menu tested the best, because in their menu, it's always following you around. It's always like near the bottom left or the bottom right. It's always visible. There's nothing hidden. Like in the Facebook Spaces menu, you have to like press an arrow to expose all of the options. And that was not intuitive to people. And then in Rec Room, you have to look at your wristwatch. You have to do the action of like looking at your wristwatch to pull up the menu. Yeah. And even though they make you learn that in the tutorial, no one could remember.
You would think that's like not a bad gesture to implement, you know, like kind of sci-fi, you're going to have a bunch of computer stuff on your wrist.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess in practice, depending on who is actually using it, or if they're even familiar with that like sci-fi idea of having like a wrist computer. It really just goes to show like you need to do your research.
Because what it was is,
Just go ahead.
Well, so the thing is that there were people in Rec Room who were trying to mute other people, or they were trying to block other people. So there was the literal UI challenge they were having, where they could not open the menu. They could not navigate the menu once it was open. And then they were in a locker room that was incredibly loud and people were talking to them, and they really wanted to be alone and they wanted to have more time. And I think like this really came through to me when the people who were doing Rec Room, they kept asking me like, where can I go and practice paintball all by myself?
Yeah.
And so it's so counterintuitive, because they're inside of a social VR app and they are asking for time to be by themselves.
Exactly. I mean, it's kind of fascinating that while there is kind of a lot of people talking about UX, so user experience in VR, a lot of applications still are just so inconsistent. And I mean, I also tend to, you know, to show VR to new people here and there and just introduce it to my friends. And it's just always so painful because I just can't anymore. It's all the time to say, where is the grip button? How do I hold it? How do I open the menu? And I mean, it's not only the problem of people freshly going in, but as Azad mentioned in the beginning, you know, Azad and me have spent many hours in VR still. When you open a new application, you're prepared to struggle with the controls. And it's just a nightmare. It's really a nightmare in a certain way.
Yeah, I mean, this part of that can be attributed to the early nature and not there being big design trends to follow, right? As a developer, you want to offload as much of
the grand general knowledge that you can pull from. So, you know, you want to spend time building the thing that you want to build, but not having to spend all the time to trying to figure out how do you create a control C, control V, you know, how to copy paste easily. And if you can just, get inspirations from other successful implementations or from someone like Facebook that has, 100 designers they could throw at a problem. Anyway, I think that's a contributing factor as to why certain things are just badly designed still in VR. It's a matter of like time and resources. But when you have stories like this coming out, I think that expedites certain priorities to the top of the list, where this is like, if you don't take care of this, you will have an internet looming down on you and like it can make or break your entire company. So
yeah. Well, I'd love to tell you what the follow-up study is to this.
Yeah.
So right now I ran a quantitative study this time. So I put together a survey about people's expectations for the future of VR. And there's questions on that survey. I just finished data collection. I have over 600 responses from people who are regular, high-end VR users. And the questions are about things like privacy, like what is your expectation about how your data is going to be used? Any data collected about you is going to be used by the platforms. Questions about, have you ever experienced any type of harassment? Was it sexual harassment? And then also, what is people's experience with the bubbles? So is putting up a bubble, is it genuinely effective? Is it really effective to mute or block others? So really what I'm trying to do is get a sense of, for the existing tools that are out there, are they working? And I think I've only started looking at the data this week, but one of the things that I'm really looking at is, to what level are men experiencing harassment as well? Because men experience harassment like online and, on the normal web. And so I think, like, I really want to have a conversation about how, are VR experiences like really delivering, and like, are they working for people? And are the existing anti-harassment or anti-griefing tools effective for people?
Yeah.
So the results of that study are going to come out at the end of the month.
Cool.
So people can, they can sign up on my website and like, they'll get a copy of the results then. Or you can just follow me on Twitter and you'll see that. But
what's your Twitter handle?
Like this first, it's at the Extended Mind.
Simple. Nice.
Nice.
And then my website is extendedmind.io. And so if you subscribe for updates, then you'll see when the full results come out.
Yeah.
So what I was really trying to do in this study is validate some of the initial findings that I had in the qualitative study. So in the qualitative study, I only had 13 participants, and that was because I spent an hour and a half with each of those participants. So it was very labor intensive.
Sure.
And so, we pulled out all of these particular threads about what we found were concerns about social VR. And so now we turned a lot of those into questions that we put on the quantitative survey, and now we have 600 responses.
Nice.
And so that's part of like what the research process is. It's like you use qualitative research to discover like what are the stories, what's really going on, and then try to validate that with larger groups of people.
No, it's very important what you're doing. It's a very big,
very big
contribution to a more nicer to enjoy VR, but also basically pushing those methods that you use inside VR, because a lot of VR is driven by young entrepreneurs and startups that are kind of, let's just do it and go along with it. And there is just not much scientific approach that is sometimes useful, just get people to use it, use some methods, do a survey, and it's great.
The idea of build fast and break things, I think, is pretty consistent across these things. Before we wrap things up, I think
we're obviously very excited about the results of the study, and we'll for sure post it on our Twitter and Facebook page as well. Off the top of your head, and with some of the experiences that you have in VR, are there certain apps or implementations of design principles that come to mind that you would like to like reference and reference as like good practices for developers that are listening to implement? Or would that be part of the study?
Oh yeah. I mean, I think like the biggest like takeaway is think about the behavior that you want people to have when they're inside of your app. And just be really thoughtful about what that is. So do you want people to feel really competitive with each other? Do you want people to feel really collaborative with one another? How do you want people to feel like when they first arrive? Because it's really up to the, like, there's going to be social norms that develop. Like, social norms is just like, how do people behave when no one is looking? When they're not being like, you know, supervised by a moderator. And so really think about what is the behavior that you want to have and then work backwards from there. And if you don't have strong preferences, you know, the social norms will develop without you.
Right.
If you do have strong preferences about what you want your social norms to be, then, you know, pick up an organizational behavior textbook. I mean, companies and schools and like, you know, churches and like every type of organizing like institution in our society has been thinking about developing social norms for hundreds of years.
Yeah.
So don't feel like you're on your own and that there's no resources out there. Like there's
definitely is
gazillions of like social science research that's already there about how to develop social norms. And so that's why I was asking about, you know, what's it like to be our VR chat employee? Because like, is VR chat really thoughtful about the company culture that they're building? Like, how are they attracting like engineers? Like, what are they doing to attract talent? Like, how do VR chat employees act with each other when there's no managers around? And so it's really the exact same. If you think about it like that, it makes it a much smaller question. Is like, how do you want people to treat each other when there's no one there? When there's no like authority figure. Right.
And I think you can't, I mean, the idea of having a paid moderator to be in a room to moderate this isn't like the most scalable thing, obviously.
Yeah.
Oh, I think that's, I want to go on the record and say, I don't think that's going to solve anything. Fair. I mean, if you think about like, what is one of the least safe places in the world for you to live in? Like, it would probably be in a jail. And in a jail, you are constantly moderated by other people. Mm. So I really don't think that, like, monitoring is the solution. I think coming up with social norms are the solution.
Totally fair.
And get people to do the work for you.
And to be fair, I do want to throw this out there. So in terms of, we're talking about VR chat and some of the problems that have come up, and there was a more... famous one that happened on Twitter, at least, where a woman was like, this is my 32nd first time experience in VR chat. And it was just like, she felt surrounded by a bunch of people yelling memes at her. And then that kind of picked up some steam. And to be fair, the VR chat developers quickly responded to this. Yes. And I don't know exactly what they implemented, but I mean,
they tried to delete the model from Knuckles. But it didn't work out that well. No. So I mean,
well, that's not
thousands just of people. Yeah, true.
But
you have thousands of
anyway,
people trying to, you know, to overrun your servers. I mean, you can't do anything. You're basically screwed, and you have to enjoy the TikTok.
Yeah, the original poster of on that, you know, the complaint came back, and she was pretty happy with like that they're making a big effort on trying to moderate this, and I'm sure it's not.
Yeah.
You know, no developer wants to create a toxic culture of any sense, but sometimes when
I am gonna please interrupt you, because yes, like that person that female that did have the negative experience, I think the thing is that she is an employee of Oculus, and she, like, just think about the power dynamics of her. So Yes, she did come back and was like, oh, I'm really happy about the responses, the response of VR chat. The thing is that think about the like what it would be like for her to apply to a job somewhere else, like once she's ready to leave Oculus. Or think about, so yes, she did respond, like, and maybe that is the case, but, you know, like the same thing happened when Cy Wise of the computing job simulator.
Alchemy Labs, yeah.
Alchemy, thank you. So yeah, so she was harassed in Rec Room, and then she put that online, and she talked about the harassment, and Rec Room, like, reached out to her and was like, oh my gosh, we're so sorry. And she was like, oh, like, thank you so much. But I think the thing is that for the Oculus employee and for the Alchemy employee, like, they are going, they're, like, being, you know, you have to, like, acknowledge that the power dynamics of this industry are such that if they don't act cool about what happened.
Yes.
No, you're totally right about that. And to that point, actually, she, even just this week, I think she posted, she's like, okay, guys, enough. Like, I don't want to answer anyone's questions. Stop sending me requests for, you know, quotes and interviews. Like, clearly she wants to be out of the limelight of you know, of being a victim in VR. And it, I mean, I can understand that from any direction, even as if you're a person working in the industry, which puts you at a even, you know, more harder situation. So thank you for noting that. Anyway, it's a definitely a tough discussion. It's a tough thing to figure this out from both developers and as well as users wanting to, you know, make this known, but also not want to be scrutinized for it in a you know, maybe if it's not explicit way, but implicit. Anyway, so it's definitely tough. I don't even know exactly how to tackle it, but I'm glad we're having this conversation to at least.
It's a good step forward.
Yeah, it's a good step forward.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks, everyone. No sailing and no NASCAR.
Is that the takeaway?
The developer. Just build VR platforms that people don't already have a lot of associations about.
That's fair. Or
let,
like,
people fly to the moon.
Flip the dynamic, you know? Take a very bourgeois activity and I don't know, make it less elite.
Or come up with, like, brand new things. This is, like, the wonderful part of the technology.
All right, guys. Thank you all for being here. Jessica, once again, if you can tell people how they can find you and reach you and find your work.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. All right. So on Twitter, I'm at The Extended Mind. If people want to follow the Oculus Launchpad DBIOS project, that is at DBIOS VR, so they can follow updates there. And then my partner in that project is at Creative Clo. Her name's Kurama Dorvilius. And I would recommend that if you're of any interest in seeing how, like, these types of research are being implemented inside of VR, like, please follow us.
Definitely. You guys always have, I follow you guys, and you particularly have great tweets about this entire topic. And if you haven't already, follow Research VR Research VR Podcast on Twitter at Research VR Cast and on Facebook at Research VR Podcast. Follow me at AzadUX on Twitter. And you can find me
follow
on Facebook.
His YouTube channel.
Oh, yeah.
The YouTube channel of Azad is actually really cool.
We've mentioned that before. But Peter, if you want to throw your tag in there.
Just try to find me, but more importantly, try to find our Discord and join it so you can communicate with us.
Yeah, I think, Jessica, I think I saw your name pop up in the community, so that's also somewhere that
they can
reach you as well.
Yay!
All right, guys, thank you all for joining and listening, and we'll see you guys next time.
Goodbye.
Okay. Bye. Thanks. Bye-bye.